Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about a health care topic, something that we try to do, well, I think at least once a year. Sometimes we end up talking about it a little bit more, but on some kind of a regular basis, and that is heart disease. And it is the case that no matter how much you try to do the right thing, and certainly a lot of people are, heart disease, well, it's not completely preventable. However, there is some good news here, and that is over the past 20 years, as a result of advancements in our knowledge and in treatment, the mortality rate from heart disease has been cut in half. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about heart disease and what it is and what you can do to reduce your risk. And then once someone gets that diagnosis, then how you approach treatment. And our guest for all of this is Dr. Jerome Granato. He is a medical director of the coronary care unit at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's also a fellow of the American College of Cardiology and the Council on Clinical Cardiology at the American Heart Association. So, as you can tell from all of that, the heart is his special area of focus. He is the author of a recently published book that's titled Living with Coronary Heart Disease, and it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. It is a paperback book, so it's not going to be terribly expensive. And if you're interested in getting more information, maybe you have now been diagnosed with heart disease, or you know that there's heart disease in your family, or you have a family member who does, there would be good information in here for anyone who falls into any of those categories. Questions are certainly welcome. I know the doctor will do his best to answer your question, but one thing I just want to mention here at the beginning, and I say this every time we have a doctor on the program, do keep in mind that we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone because the doctor cannot see you. We do programs like this to try to add to your basic health knowledge, but of course, if you have a particular concern about yourself, you need to go to the doctor and talk to the person who can see you. But, you know, now having said all that, I don't want to discourage people from calling. Questions welcome, and I'm sure that he'll do his best to answer your questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So questions are certainly welcome. Well, and Dr. Granato, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm very good as well. Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, I appreciate you doing this. As I've said, this is one subject that we like to, on a fairly regular basis at least, try to have on the program because I think it's good to continue to remind people of, you know, what heart disease is about and what some of the risk factors are and how people can lower their risk and, you know, give folks a chance to ask questions because I think it – am I correct that heart disease is still the number one killer in the United States?
It's the number one killer in the United States. And as we mentioned in the book, more people die of heart disease every single day in this country than die in any war or natural disaster.
Okay.
It is a huge healthcare issue. No question it has gotten substantially better over the past 20 years, as you've mentioned, but there's little doubt that heart disease will touch us or someone in our family. And we need to be knowledgeable about it.
And that's and I think it's always one of the things if we do a show like this, we always try to make the point that there may well be things that people can't control. They certainly can't control the genes they have inherited, but there are a lot of other things that they can control, lifestyle-related things like smoking and do they get exercise and what kind of diet do they have? And all of those things can contribute either to your risk of heart disease or to lowering your risk of heart disease.
There's no question about that. And you're right again. At least at this point in time, we can't control our genes. But, you know, the genetic aspects and the genetic risk of heart disease is only one, and quite frankly, a fairly small component of the overall risk for developing heart disease. As you've mentioned, and what I tell patients, probably one of the biggest risks of heart disease is making the wrong choice. And the wrong choice is choosing to smoke. Mm. Clearly, it is a decision that many people end up regretting. as they become addicted to it. But there's little doubt in any of the literature that smoking increases your risk of developing heart disease probably more than any other risk factor. And as a result, there's a huge national effort to educate people with respect to the perils of smoking. You can choose not to smoke. But there are other choices, too, as you again alluded to. The choice to be active or to be inactive. The choice to eat healthy or not eat healthy. These are things that have a huge impact on our risk of developing heart disease and very well are in our control. And in the book, we talk about how these things add together or even multiply together to increase your risk of developing heart disease.
Yeah. Just I'm not sure for most people what they really know about heart disease. I would expect, though, that they've at least gotten the basic message that the central problem here is when your blood vessels, particularly those that the big ones that are there close to the heart, for a variety of reasons, and I think they also understand that what you eat has something to do with this, that the blood vessels become blocked, the blood doesn't flow well the way that it should, and that ultimately if they become blocked enough, you could have a heart attack. So there's a lot of emphasis on, I think, on particularly on diet and on fat in the diet and on cholesterol. And while I'm sure that that's all right and those are all good messages, do you think that are we focusing on the right things by spending so much time talking about dietary fat intake and about cholesterol?
Absolutely. And as you so nicely pointed out, what we're talking about here is one type of heart disease. Mm. In the book, we talk about there are many different types of heart disease. What we're talking about here is coronary heart disease, and the coronary arteries are the fuel supply to the engine that pumps our blood, the heart. And when we talk about coronary artery disease, we talk about the buildup of plaque that narrows and eventually plugs up these important fuel lines. And one of the important components, again, as you've mentioned, is cholesterol. And dietary cholesterol is only one form of cholesterol. There's the cholesterol that we make normally in our liver, and that may have a genetic component to it. But keeping our cholesterol within an acceptable range has to be a goal for all of us. And we can do that by dieting, by exercise, and making sure we make good choices. But as we again have pointed out, genetics is only one component, cholesterol is only one component, and if you have a normal cholesterol, yet you choose to smoke, if you will, you have done the damage.
One of the things, and I'm sure this is something that was known a long time ago, is that if you had the opportunity to, and I suppose at this time to do it, at a certain time to do it, you would have actually had to do it post-mortem, you know, when you cut somebody open and take a look at their coronary blood vessels. You would have found that actually the business of laying down plaque that would end up blocking the arteries starts really early, and that you could see in people who were teenagers already the beginnings of that. Now, I guess the question I'm going to is, well, you know, when if one is headed in that direction, if you had a heart attack when you're 55, at what age was though the blockages? At what age do you actually start to create those blockages? And would you actually, whether you did it by cutting a person open or by imaging them,
we have a couple of good ways to look.
Yeah.
And first we'll speak about the ways. The most common way and the most time-honored way and the way that we have the most experience is taking the heart for a test drive, seeing how those fuel lines work when we get the engine revving. And we call that test drive for a heart a stress test. And a stress test is the time-honored way to see how the heart performs when we step on the gas. And it's a very good way to take a look at how the heart performs and give us some sense. Doesn't let us see the blockages, but it gives us some sense as to whether these fuel lines are opened or closed. And we tend to use a stress test in patients who may have symptoms of heart disease, chest pain, shortness of breath, some difficulty with performing exercise. Or we tend to use a stress test in patients who may be at particularly high risk of developing heart disease, diabetic patients, men who have a long smoking history. But what a stress test is a functional test. It doesn't allow us to see the blockages. New ways are evolving that enable us to help see the blockages and perhaps see them earlier than they would be detected if we used a stress test. And that would be an imaging procedure. And there are two types of imaging procedures for the heart. The most common one now is called CT angiography. It's where we use x-rays and couple that with a computer to actually take pictures of the blood vessels inside the heart to see if there's plaque buildup, how much plaque buildup there is. And these are tests that can be used on a much broader scale for screening. Everybody doesn't need to have that type of screening. But if you're in middle age, if you have high blood pressure, if you are a smoker, or if you have a strong family history, a CT angiogram can be a useful way of starting to see if you have the beginnings of plaque formation. And then armed with that information, your doctor can then start to take steps to help you intervene and prevent that plaque from growing.
Well, one more question, and I promise I have a couple of people here who are waiting. I will get to them. Supposing that you have an individual who does not have a strong family history of heart disease, their weight is okay within the acceptable range. They maybe get some exercise. They don't smoke. They don't have high blood pressure. Their cholesterol is acceptable. Maybe you would look at it and say, well, I'd like it to be a little bit lower, but as far as I'm concerned, it's okay. So basically, so there's no red flags.
Right.
For a person like that, would there be any case where you think it would be worthwhile for a person like that to either have a stress test or actually for you to look more closely just to satisfy yourself and that person that they're pretty much okay?
In general, the answer to your question would be no. That what you've just described is millions and millions and millions of Americans who are quite healthy and are fairly normal, and we really don't have either the facilities or the financial resources to apply testing in a uniform manner to all of those people. We generally defer testing for people where the likelihood of finding an abnormality is higher than that, and you need to have one or two good risk factors or some symptoms. And those are the people who really benefit the most or have the highest yield when we do screening procedures for.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jerome Granato. He's medical director of the coronary care unit at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. And he is the author of the book, Living with Coronary Heart Disease, A Guide for Patients and Families. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And if you have questions about heart disease, now's the time to give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have two callers ready to go. First is in Morton Grove, and that's our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
I've had a question. I have had, or at least known of, the arterial sclerosis now for about the past 17 years. I've had three angioplasties with some stents put in, and I recently went to the doctor because of some issues with shortness of breath when I climbed the stairs or I went up on an incline. But on a level surface, I seem to be okay. And I do some exercises, elliptical machine, also some treadmill walking on a regular basis, and watch the diet, of course. I had a nuclear stress test with my physician, and I think I might have been on the machine perhaps 2 minutes. I'm not sure it was more than that, but it may have been something less than that. My question was the thought of the doctor apparently is that there does not seem to be anything showing up in that that gave him any concerns. The answer I got from the office when I called in was that the not to worry about it. And I'm sorry, but I am worried about it. And this is about a month ago that that happened. What's your thought about the testing that I went through and my recollection of the amount of time, and where else would I go perhaps as this condition or these symptoms continue? What would I do as to follow up further on this here, being that it does not seem to be going away?
You raised several very good points, and I'll try to address each of them in sequence.
Thank you.
And help you and help the audience. The first is that we have a man who has coronary disease, and he's had more than a little. It's apparently been symptomatic, and it has been treated for an extended period of time. Nonetheless, we now know that you're a patient who has this condition, and this is a condition that doesn't go away. It's a condition that will continue to make one prone for additional plaque buildup and requires lifelong medical therapy and lifelong surveillance, which is what I presume you have done for the past 17 years. The time-honored way of continuing that surveillance is with stress testing. Stress testing is a very useful test because what it does is it's functional. It takes the heart for a test drive, and what it says is that while the heart may not be perfect, it is able to do such and such, such and such, and such and such. And if we're able to show that you can do that based on your exercise capacity, based on your electrocardiogram, and based on the nuclear images, we know statistically that that carries a very favorable prognosis. And I assume that your physician, when he did the exercise test, saw that you achieved those benchmarks, and statistically that places you in a favorable prognosis. But to your point is that a stress test isn't foolproof. There are patients who may have underlying heart disease and continue to have symptoms, or there may be patients who have underlying heart disease that the stress test doesn't accurately uncover. And it's in those patients who may have continued symptoms or where the suspicion or concern is high, other tests are available. And the test that one then uses is a test that I'm sure you're familiar with. It's called a cardiac catheterization, where a tube is then placed in the heart, and the blood vessels are actually outlined with dye. The reason one doesn't jump to this test immediately is because this test does have a little bit of discomfort. We're putting a hole in the blood vessel and placing a tube inside the heart.
Usually
and it does
the groin area, doctor?
Excuse me?
Usually the groin area,
usually
right?
The groin area. And it does carry some risk. That's why, in general, one doesn't proceed with that test unless there are either continued symptoms or a high index of suspicion, and your physician is generally the person who's in the best position to make that decision. But what you've described here is not an uncommon scenario, and what we discuss in the book is that you need to be knowledgeable of all of these possibilities, you need to be knowledgeable of all of these tests, and then you need to create a dialogue with your doctor to help satisfy those answers. I hope that answers your question.
I just it does answer a great deal, doctor. I would like to be a little bit more specific, if I may. This nuclear test that I took, I say, a month ago, was approximately a few minutes on the 2 minutes, let's say, on the treadmill. In prior times when I've taken the stress test, 3 minutes warm-up, 3 minutes accelerate, and then finally they really turn up the machine. So we're talking 8-9 minutes usually on the treadmill. And in the past, at least, I've been successful that way, I'm thank goodness. But having had this nuclear test, which was kind of brand new to me, and only being on the treadmill for approximately 2 minutes, I was really concerned that, well, maybe somehow we're getting shortchanged because with the other type of test, the number of minutes was much greater, and I was put to the test, if you will, getting really revved up there at the last 2 or 3 minutes of a 9-minute test.
To answer your question, and again for the audience, there are more than one type of stress test available. There are multiple ways to stress the heart. Traditionally, stressing the heart is done with exercise, but sometimes one can trick the heart into thinking it's exercised by using certain medications. And so what one can have is a hybrid test where one does a little bit of exercise and then gets a little bit of medication to help stimulate the heart further, thus allowing one not to have as long a duration of exercise. I think it's important for the audience to know that there are different types of stress tests available, and if you can't exercise because you have arthritis or because you may be a senior citizen or because you have some other problem that may not allow you to walk on the belt that moves, your doctors can give you certain medications that can stimulate the heart and have the heart think it's exercising. So without knowing the particular details of your test, it's possible that your physician used a hybrid test that combined some exercise and some medications to perform a complete stress test.
Okay, and one, on terms of value, one would substitute very well for a much longer non-nuclear test that I may have taken in the past.
Well, again, it's hard to know, sir, without the details of all of the studies. In general, the use of nuclear imaging now as part of a stress test is a very important component, and we rely on that heavily in making these assessments as to how the heart functions with exercise.
Okay, well, I won't take any more time, but I do appreciate all that valuable information. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. We are at our midpoint here. We'll get some other callers in just a moment, just as quickly as I reintroduce our guest, Dr. Jerome Granato. He is Medical Director of the Coronary Care Unit at Allegheny General Hospital. That's in Pittsburgh. And he is the author of the book, Living with Coronary Heart Disease, A Guide for Patients and Families, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Next, we'll talk with someone here where we are in Champaign, Line 1. Hello.
Yes, Dr. Granato. I have you've answered most of my questions, or most of parts of my question, but I have a little bit of a different one for you. I have a family history of heart disease on mother and father's side, and I have hypertension controlled with medication. I am recently a non-smoker as of about 5 days. However, I did quit for 11 years previously. My question is this. Do you think I am a candidate? I think I am for maybe the CT angiography. And the other part of my question is, I had a stress echocardiogram a few years ago and was diagnosed with sleep apnea after I had an abnormality on it. It was spiking P waves. Now, I've been worried about those P waves ever since, and I wonder if they could indicate any other problems. And that's it.
Well, I think you raised several points that I'd like to make. The first is that many people believe that coronary heart disease is a disease of men, and it's not. Actually, there are just as many women who have coronary heart disease as there are men, and in fact, if you look at our elderly population, there are more women than men who have coronary heart disease. So just because one is a woman, that doesn't necessarily
mean, I don't believe that.
That doesn't necessarily mean that they're free from heart disease. So you are indeed a candidate, particularly women as they approach their middle years after menopause has begun. They've lost some of the protective effects of estrogen. And so for all of those reasons, you clearly are someone who would benefit from a screening procedure. From what you've spoken to me today, it sounds like you do have significant risk factors for heart disease. And first, they must be controlled. And I would urge you to please stop smoking. It's the most important thing. Yeah, it's the most important thing you can do. Watch your blood pressure and then work with your physician to have some sort of screening procedure on a periodic basis. And again, dependent upon your other medical conditions, whether that be a stress echocardiogram, a stress nuclear study, or a imaging procedure, all of those provide various benefits in the right patient population, and your doctor can help you there. With respect to these spiking P waves, I must admit I'm not so sure I understand exactly what you're referring to. It's not a term that I'm entirely familiar with. People who do have obstructive sleep apnea, a condition that occurs sometimes when people are a bit overweight, they have difficulty breathing at night, and their blood oxygen goes down because they either stop breathing or breathe very slowly, can have a bad effect on the heart, causing the upper chambers or sometimes even the lower chambers to enlarge. So people with sleep apnea do need to have their heart looked at periodically. They do need to have treatment and care for that, and I would urge you to continue to work with your doctor to do that.
Thank you. I will. Can I say one thing about smoking and quitting smoking? Just one thing. I had doctors, when they find out you're a smoker or you have a history of smoking, they give up on you a little bit. And that's the last thing that they should do, because we need encouragement from doctors. Like, tell me about what's available to help me quit. I know you have to make up your mind first, but a lot of people need help gently from the doctor. Don't give up on your smokers. Be encouraging.
I would agree with you. Stopping smoking is one of the hardest things you can ask a patient to do.
Don't just tell them to quit. They don't know how to quit.
I agree.
Nicotine withdrawal. Awful. Thank you.
All right,
I'm going to get off here now.
Thank you for the call. Let's go. We'll talk next with someone in Chicago. This is line two. Hello. Is there a caller there in Chicago, line two? All right. Well, I'm sorry. We have a problem with that one. We'll go to someone in Urbana, line three.
Yes.
Hello. Yes, hello.
I know so much less about heart problems than the people who have been calling in. I found that recently a good friend has been diagnosed with like a fluttering heart, that there's a word for that. It's a long word, and I'm concerned about what he has to look forward to as far as the development of this. He evidently used to have it off and on, and now it happens almost all the time. And can you give me the word that I want?
Well, I'll try to. Many patients describe a fluttering feeling in the heart. The word that they sometimes use to describe this is a palpitation.
But that's not the word the doctor would
use. I understand. And it's a palpitation because they can feel it.
Yes. Uh-huh.
What they don't know, and what I don't know, is this fluttering in the heart can come from certain locations. Sometimes the fluttering can come from the upper chambers, and we call that fluttering of the upper chambers atrial fibrillation.
That's the word, yes.
Atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter. Sometimes the fluttering can come from the lower chambers, the ventricle, and this is a different condition entirely.
I see.
Depending upon where the fluttering is originating, from the upper chamber or from the lower chamber, will determine on the type of treatment that the patient needs. It will also determine the types of risk that the patient may face over the future. Fluttering from the upper chambers is sometimes associated with a higher risk of stroke, and many times patients with fluttering from the upper chamber require blood thinners.
Yes.
Fluttering from the lower chambers is associated with heart attacks and other conditions and require different types of medications. My point for the audience here is that if you do have an irregular heartbeat or if you do have fluttering sensation, it's something that probably should be evaluated by the doctor, because there are a number of very effective treatments for both conditions, and a number of things that your doctor can do to help prevent this from going any further and really making you live a pretty good and normal life. So there's a lot of stuff that can be done, but you have to determine more precisely the type of fluttering and where it's originating in the heart.
Well, I know my friend is on Coumadin, so does that suggest the upper? Would you not prescribe Coumadin for the lower?
Well, sometimes you do prescribe Coumadin for the lower chambers as well if they're enlarged or if there's been a valve problem or a heart attack. So it's hard to know very clearly, but typically fluttering of the upper chambers does require a blood thinner.
Yes.
But there are certain types of fluttering from the upper chamber that can be treated and eliminated. And as a result, people don't need to have Coumadin over the long haul. So it's important to get good advice and get this evaluated thoroughly. These are common problems as well.
Yes. My friend he swims 3 days a week and then he exercises the other two.
Yep.
So he continues to be physically active. I'm assuming that that's a good thing.
Yes, it is. And it speaks more towards fluttering from the upper chambers. Many, many patients can have fluttering from the upper chambers and live long and healthy lives. As I like to say, it's sometimes more of a nuisance than a danger to have fluttering from the upper chamber.
I see. So now when you were describing what could be an outcome for the upper and lower, did you say upper was a heart attack, or was that the lower?
Neither one. Sometimes fluttering of the lower chamber is related to a prior heart attack, but the fluttering doesn't mean you've had a heart attack or will have a heart attack, but it's something that requires some further investigation.
I see. Well, he's under good care, and he continues his physical activity. Then my second question is, I'm wondering if you know about a product that I just heard about this week. The name of it is Stereotaxis, and it is a method of inserting a very small tube up through the body into the heart by use of a very small magnet at the end of the tube and then large magnets on either side. And I had never heard about this type of entry and progression through the body. And I just wondered if you are familiar with Stereotaxis. It's a company in St. Louis.
I have heard of this. I would not say that I am familiar with
it.
What you've described is a technique that is currently under investigation at some hospitals. It is not what I would call a first-line or mainline treatment for any form of heart condition.
I want to thank the caller. We have some others. Can I just add, I wanted to say one quick question here. I think that people understand that if they have been doing the wrong things that we have talked about, the things that contribute to your risk, and that if they change their behavior, start doing the right things, and if heart disease is present or there's the possibility that you can keep things from getting worse, there are also people who have argued that if you really start doing the right things, that actually the coronary artery blockages, the blood vessel blockages, can actually be reversed by doing the right things and having good diet and exercise and having the right outlook and so forth and so on. I'm wondering what you think about that. Can in fact, by non-surgical lifestyle adjustments, these things actually be reversed and not just halted?
The concept of changing the nature of the blockage inside your heart is clearly something that is evolving. There's little question that we can take these blockages now and change their complexion and change their nature. And in doing so, we can cause them to shrink a little bit. Unfortunately, one can't have blood vessels that are significantly clogged and unclog them with either medicine or lifestyle change. We can reduce it to some degree. We can improve the degree of obstruction to some degree with lifestyle changes. And probably the best lifestyle program that has produced these types of changes in the so-called Dean Ornish program.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very rigorous program of diet and exercise, but there's no question that committed people through diet and exercise can produce some improvement in the degree of blockage and a significant improvement in both the quantity and quality of their life. There are other ways to change the complexion or the nature of that blockage. Medications can do it as well. One of the real big advancements has been the use of a family of drugs called statins. These are drugs that people know as Lipitor or Zocor or Pravacol that, in addition to lowering the level of cholesterol, they seem to change the way the plaque or the obstruction is inside the heart. They reduce the amount of inflammation. And in doing so, they significantly reduce the chances of dying and having another heart attack. So to your point, sir, is that just because you've now had the diagnosis of a coronary blockage, that doesn't mean that there isn't anything that can't be done. There are a number of things that you can do as a patient to reduce the likelihood of these plaques getting worse, and there are a number of things that we can do as doctors by prescribing the right type of medication to prevent progression of this blockage.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other callers. We'll go next to Chicago, line four.
You addressed a couple of questions I was going to ask. One was about Dr. Ornish's success, and you've acknowledged his degree. Another one was about inflammation. Apart from the statins and other things, what are the contributing things to inflammation and what we might do to ameliorate that? I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Yeah. Well, you've hit a hot topic in cardiovascular disease, this concept of having inflamed plaque inside the heart. In my book, Living with Coronary Heart Disease, I use the model that this plaque buildup inside the heart or inside the coronary artery is a lot like a zit or a pimple. It can grow, it can become inflamed, it gets softer, and it eventually pops and a blood clot forms. And people can visualize a pimple doing that, and they have a harder time visualizing a cholesterol plaque. The inflammation is brought about by many things. Some of that inflammation may be brought about by smoking. Some of that inflammation may be brought about by the cholesterol molecules themselves. The way we've now learned to fight this inflammation is with a multiple-prong attack. One very easy way to help fight this inflammation is to take aspirin. Aspirin, as you know, has certain anti-inflammatory properties, and the combination of reducing inflammation and reducing the chance of blood clots have made aspirin a very effective therapy for both treatment and prevention of heart disease. I alluded to it earlier that this class of medication called statins have important properties. Not only do they seem to reduce the level of cholesterol, but they also seem to reduce the degree of inflammation inside the heart at the level of the plaque. We've now developed blood tests that can start to look at this degree of inflammation. And this blood test is called a C-reactive protein. If you will, it's a chemical barometer for how much inflammation is going on in the heart. And in the book, we talk about the usefulness of measuring this C-reactive protein. And there's excellent data now available that says if you have a high C-reactive protein, your risk of having a heart attack is high. And if we could intervene with medications or lifestyle to reduce the level of this C-reactive protein, we have very good information that shows that your risk of heart disease has become less. And so inflammation is something that we're focusing on a great deal now with different medication and different therapies. And the readers and listeners of this program will hear a lot more about the role of inflammation in heart disease in years to come. Very good question.
All right. And we'll continue. The next person is in Decatur. Line number one. Hello.
Yes. good morning. You probably already answered my question. I want to just get your thoughts on long-term usage of the statins, and I assume it's going to be right. I was a research chemist for ADM, learned a long time ago that omega-6s were pro-inflammatory, omega-6 fats versus omega-3 fats, which are anti-inflammatory. So I'll hang up and get your opinion off the air.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Again, as you said, there are multiple ways to fight inflammation. The statin class of drugs are very, very good ways of doing that. Raising one of our types of cholesterol called HDL is another way of fighting inflammation. And right now, the only ways we have to raise HDL is with exercise, perhaps with a gentle alcohol consumption or some types of vitamins or fatty acids. On the horizon, there may be other medications that may be useful in raising this HDL or good cholesterol that seems to have very beneficial effects in reducing the amount of cardiac inflammation. So, again, very good questions.
We'll go to one more caller here. This is Champagne in line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been hearing a lot about vitamin D. Can you talk about vitamin D and its relationship to the heart, and should people be taking vitamin D on a regular basis?
Vitamin D is an important vitamin with respect to the control of calcium in our body. It has a very important effect with bone formation and calcium deposits. Its role with respect to heart disease is less understood. And I'm not all that familiar with the role of vitamin D specifically in how it impacts coronary heart disease. A vitamin that has gained, two vitamins that have gained lots of press with respect to heart disease is vitamin E. Vitamin E has what we may call antioxidant or properties. Oxidation is part of this inflammation that we're talking about. And the use of vitamin E may have some role in preventing heart disease. The other vitamin that has had a lot of insight is folic acid. Folic acid may also have some effect in preventing the buildup of plaque formation, and that's particularly true if you have a metabolic problem with a drug called with a substance called homocysteine. Folic acid won't be helpful for everyone, but if you do have elevated homocysteine levels, folic acid may be of benefit to you. But vitamin D, I come up with at a loss. I wish I could help you more there.
Thank you.
All right. Just to return for a moment to the subject of statins, because this, I think, has also been something where there's been a lot of debate within healthcare around the question who should be taking them, with some people making the argument that lots and lots of people should be taking them as almost a prophylactic, and others say, no, that's we don't want to do that. You only really want to give them to people where you really know they're at risk and they have a problem. And as you think about it, who do you think should be on these cholesterol-lowering medications?
Well, we're learning more and more about the use of these drugs as the years go by, but a couple of things are clear. If you have had a heart attack, or if you have documented evidence of plaque buildup, an abnormal stress test, or have had chest pains, that patient group clearly will benefit from the use of a statin agent. You've already shown that you've got heart disease, and there's no question if you have heart disease, taking a statin, and probably taking it forever, decreases your risk of future heart attacks. No doubt there. Another group of patients that benefit from the use of statins is diabetic patients. Patients with diabetes have a markedly higher risk of having heart disease. And once again, here the data is very clear that if you're diabetic, whether you've had a heart attack or not, whether you have documented heart disease or not, diabetic patients do better with the prophylactic use of a statin agent. After those two groups, the data becomes a little bit more murky. I think that the data is strong if you are in a very high risk group, your cholesterol is excessively high, or you have a certain family history of a lipid disorder. In those groups, taking a statin agent may be of benefit. But if your cholesterol is normal and you don't have any significant risk factors and you don't have evidence of heart disease elsewhere, there's probably no benefit. But clearly, if you've had a heart attack, if you have heart disease, or if you're diabetic, a statin agent is in your future and has shown to be very effective.
All right. To another caller. This is Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a question.
Yes.
Is prediabetes a disposer? I can't think of the word.
Predisposer, yes.
Predisposer,
ma'am.
For heart problems.
Yes, ma'am, it is. There is a condition that we call the metabolic syndrome, which is not quite diabetes, but you're on your way there. And there's little question that if you have the metabolic syndrome, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute, that your risk from heart disease is greater. The good news is if we've identified you as having this metabolic syndrome and having a higher risk of having heart disease, if we intervene and get you to reverse some of the bad things that are causing this metabolic syndrome or this pre-diabetic state, your risk for heart disease go down. Metabolic syndrome is seen in patients who have a very characteristic profile. They tend to be overweight, and the higher weight tends to be localized in their belly and in their torso. They tend to have higher levels of triglycerides and lower levels of good cholesterol, or HDL. Their sugar may not necessarily be diabetic yet, but left to their own devices, patients with this truncal obesity, high triglyceride, and low HDL are prone to go on to develop diabetes and heart disease. And when we see people who have that triad or that metabolic syndrome, if we get them to lose weight, if we get them to exercise, if we get them to lower the triglycerides and see their good cholesterol increase, guess what? They do better, and their risk of heart disease gets better as well.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're
all
welcome.
Right. And we'll go to another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I just wondered if the doctor could discuss the relationship between having chemotherapy and heart disease. If we've had like an episode of breast cancer and some aggressive chemotherapy sessions.
Yes, ma'am. You raise a very, very good question. Certainly, if you have cancer, you need to get it treated, and that treatment generally involves some degree of chemotherapy and some degree of radiation. Certain chemotherapy agents, particularly ones that are used for breast cancer, may impact on the heart. They can cause the heart muscle to weaken. They can cause the heart muscle to enlarge. And the use of these agents, which are very effective in treating the cancer, can sometimes, unfortunately, cause damage to the heart. This requires close observation by your oncologist, and frequently requires the observation of a cardiologist. In addition, patients who have cancer sometimes get radiation, whether it be radiation for breast cancer or radiation for lung cancer, and the radiation can sometimes affect the heart as well, increasing the risk of having heart disease there, and these patients likewise need to be closely monitored. It's unfortunately a side effect and a consequence of very good therapy. You need to have that therapy to treat the cancer, but you need to have those other things looked at as well.
Does that...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a time frame, for example, if you have had the treatment, chemotherapy, say 5 years, 10 years, 15 years out, is there a time frame where heart disease would kind of show up?
That's, again, an excellent question. In general, when one has a chemotherapy-related heart problem, the heart problem occurs shortly after the administration of chemotherapy. If you had chemotherapy 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, the risk for having heart disease now is not related to any chemotherapy that you had. It's independent of that.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
All right. Well, thank you. We're essentially the part where we must stop. I'm there's all sorts of questions that I'm tempted to ask, and I think I should just not, because I wouldn't be able to give you enough time really to answer thoroughly. Certainly I would suggest to people, if you're interested in reading about heart disease, you can look for the book that we mentioned by our guest, Living with Coronary Heart Disease, A Guide for Patients and Families. It is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press by our guest, Dr. Jerome Granato. He is medical director of the Coronary Care Unit at Allegheny General Hospital. That's in Pittsburgh. Any just last quick thoughts you'd like to leave with folks?
Yes, I do have one, is that what I hope I've shown you today is that living with heart disease and learning about heart disease is possible. It doesn't need to be a black box. Every patient in this country can and should understand their illness and become very well-versed and be able to engage in a discussion of it.
All right. Well, Dr. Granato, thank you very much.
Thank you.